From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NPR's Kelly McKevers' new podcast, Embedded, takes a story and goes deep. Her latest takes us to San Salvador, capital of El Salvador, one of the most murder-plagued cities in the world, a city where violent gangs exercise terrible, brutal authority, where gangs have gone so far as declaring open season war on the police. Kelly was there in the thick of a spate of bus driver killings. Her reporting helps explain why people are desperate to flee. This hour on Point, Embedded, on the shocking violence in El Salvador. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen Central America's problem up close? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the political turmoil in Brazil. But first to Embedded. Kelly was there last summer when suddenly gang members started setting city buses on fire, and then it got worse. They started murdering bus drivers. Here from early in Episode 3 of Embedded.
The song you're hearing is from a funeral for a bus driver. It's in a cemetery on top of a hill in a small village outside the capital of El Salvador. His name was Mauricio Rondero, and he was killed while driving his bus at 5 o'clock in the morning. His relatives and some cemetery workers are shoveling dirt onto a mound.
They covered him in dirt, and now they're putting flowers into the dirt, as they say. Hammering the cross into the dirt. His mother is just crying.
Oh, what is she saying?
She said, what hurts me the more is the way in which they have taken away my son.
Mauricio Rondero was killed on a Monday morning. By Monday afternoon, San Salvador, the capital of what is already one of the most violent countries in the world, has come to an almost complete standstill. That's when we start following this bus crisis, minute by minute. At this point, we have no idea why it has started and no idea what's going to happen.
That day would get a lot worse. Embedded, the podcast. They're joining me now from NPR West in Culver City is Kelly McKevers. You know her as co-host of All Things Considered and from her years of award-winning reporting as a correspondent for NPR in the Middle East and beyond, now host of the new NPR podcast, Embedded. You can find links to the latest episode at our website, onpointradio.org. Kelly McKevers, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why were you in El Salvador?
We were actually there reporting on this question of, you know, why are thousands of people coming to the United States? We all remember the so-called surge of migrants in the summer of 2014. It was tens of thousands of people coming from Central America, you know, unaccompanied minors, children without their parents, parents with their children. And I think a lot of people at the time and still had this question of why. Why such a big number of people? Why were so many people coming? And we're actually seeing another sort of second surge now from that same region. And so we went to talk in particular to women and girls. We were interested in why, you know, why would a 13-year-old girl leave home and make the journey, you know, thousands of miles through her own country.
Crazy until you understand.
Mexico. Yeah. Right. And get to Texas alone and then try to claim asylum in this country. And so we were there. We were meeting women and girls. We'd spent about a week, 10 days talking to tons of girls from all over the country in El Salvador, people who tried to leave. And what we were just hearing over and over and over again from these women and these girls is it is the gangs. It's these two gangs that basically run El Salvador, Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18. Those are the two main gangs. And we were just about to wrap up our reporting when we got word of this bus crisis, as they called it in the local press, or they called it a bus strike, but it wasn't really a strike.
Sounds kind of benign when you learn what it really is.
Right, yeah, when you say it like that. I mean, the gangs had basically issued this statement that said, anyone who rides the bus or who drives a bus on these certain routes, you will be targeted and you will be killed. And they made good on the promise starting on a Monday morning. They started killing people. Mauricio Rendero, as you just heard, was the first one. In the end, 8 bus drivers and 1 transit worker were killed in just a 24-hour period. So people stopped driving buses. People stopped taking buses. I mean, the city basically came to a standstill. And the idea was that gangs were flexing their muscle. They were trying to say to the government, which has been cracking down on these gangs, we're the ones in control. You can't come and arrest us. You can't haul us in and put us in solitary confinement in these maximum security prisons. We're the ones in charge.
And suddenly, it was a very, very weird day. Let me get some more tape in here, yeah. Kelly, if I may. I mean, you were there with Jasmine Garst interpreting for you, along with Salvadoran journalist named Roberto. We'll hear more from him. Photojournalist and Carney Pindado in the center of the city. This threat has been made. They're in front of the National Palace in San Salvador. The army is beginning to arrange transportation for people to get to their homes. It is a very weird day. Embedded puts you right in the middle of it.
So there's a bunch of buses down here. There's buses that look like school buses and a big formation of army dudes with M16s. A lot of them have their faces covered with balaclavas.
The government clearly has to show it can still help people. Jasmine and I see a bunch of people getting on the buses, and they look scared. Like, they just want to get home or go to work if they have a night job.
This gives me such a bad feeling, these buses.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would get on one. I mean, they'd probably be targets too, you know? So yeah, now they're just writing the names on each bus, like which neighborhood it's going to go to, basically.
This bus is going to take 2 or 3 agents on it, like heavily armed.
That's Roberto talking to Jasmine.
He says you have to get on. I mean, people have to work.
Roberto gets a message on his phone.
Another driver just got murdered.
That's a 5th bus driver who's just been killed, presumably by the gangs.
Yeah, no, he says, I'm telling you, it's going to get bloodier.
Tonight.
The local reporters start scrambling. I go tell Encarni, who's taking pictures.
There's another driver that's been killed.
Just now, yes.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Yeah, I think so.
Kelly McEvers and her team in San Salvador, to your credit, you pivoted. You went straight at this, and it went on and on and on. And the murders just kept coming all day long. After the gang threat, they were making good on that. Maybe the ultimate power in San Salvador felt like it on that day. What did they want, Kelly? Why do they want to shut down bus transportation?
You know, there's a lot of theories at the time, and I think the one that prevailed was they wanted their leaders who were being held in these maximum security prisons and solitary confinement to be put back down into the regular prisons with the regular population, because from there they can still direct business. I mean, we're talking about gangs that number in the tens of thousands in a country of several million. I mean, it's not that the numbers are all that huge, but they are so very powerful and they exercise a lot of power from prison. And that this was basically what their demand was at the time. I mean, I think what we've seen, I mean, we did this reporting last summer. We've seen that since then, the government has only cracked down on the gangs more and the gangs have only responded with more violence.
A couple of days ago, they declared war again on the government.
On the police.
Yeah.
Basically saying, you know, the police, it's open season on the police. The police themselves are terrified. You heard us mention how the soldiers at downtown, their faces were covered with balaclavas.
Yep.
You see authorities anywhere. They're afraid. Exactly. You don't see their faces on TV when they're talking about gangs. The TV cameras, it's just sort of this understanding. They point at their feet or they point at their epaulets. I mean, they won't even point at their badge because they don't want to show their name. A lot of times they won't give their name, even if they're giving a press conference. They won't give you their full name. And this just shows you how terrified people are if even the police are that scared. You know, there was a time when the government negotiated a truce with the gangs a few years back, and that lasted for some time, but it all fell apart. And a lot of the local journalists we talked to, a lot of the people in El Salvador said that, you know, this increased crackdown, it's only leading to, you know, an escalation in the violence. It's not
leading to
slowdown.
It can feel like war. And the scenes, yeah, the scenes you report here, I want to get in there one more time. You know, it's later in the evening, and the crime scene, the police have been there. They said, you know, bring coffee and bread. It's going to be a long night. They call a press conference at a certain point. The dead bus driver's arm is hanging out the window. Here you go.
So the police just pulled the guy's arm out of the window.
The dead bus driver's arm.
Had a light on it for a second.
The arm goes back in. The reporters don't really notice. They keep eating Cheetos and drinking coffee. We sit down on the curb. Some of the people who've come out of their houses to watch the cops start going home. The investigators finish what they're doing in the bus. And then the police say they want to talk to all the reporters about a block away. But because the street is totally blocked off by police tape that's surrounding the crash bus, to get where they're going to be, we have to go around the long way. My leg is bumping against my mic, making this weird noise as we go. So the cops say they're going to give a press conference about what happened to this bus driver. And now the entire press corps is walking down this random train track through a slum. On one side of us are these really crude shacks made out of plywood. People in tank tops and shorts are sitting outside, staring at us. Our driver's putting his backpack out so the stray dogs don't attack me, which is very nice of him. Yeah, well, these are like serious slums along this train track. It's literally like ill-advised. But we're all together. All right, we're back out on the street now.
Kelly McCovers from Embedded, and you're right in the thick of it. I mean, do you get the feeling in a situation like that that your reporting is going to make a difference on this, Kelly?
Wow, what a great question. I mean, you have to believe that or else you wouldn't do this job. You have to believe that telling the story is going to perk someone's ears up and
somewhere,
and
someplace, do something.
Somewhere, somehow spur them to action. I mean, yeah, so, but yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, should I be an aid worker? That's a great big question that, that one asks oneself in the middle of all this. You know, that was the
middle
of
the night. Or be back in Culver City having a cup of coffee, pretending it's not going on, but it is.
Talking to Tom Ashford.
But it is. Yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the astonishing violence on the streets of Central America, specifically El Salvador and the capital San Salvador, where Kelly McCovers, host of the NPR podcast Embedded, has, well, from where she's brought us a new round of reporting. She joins us today from NPR West in California, and you can join us as well if you've heard this or if you haven't heard it yet. Have you heard the stories of Central American violence and thought, oh yeah, they just want to come north, live the dream? Should U.S. policy change if it really is a nightmare down there? How? Does it make you want to open the border? Close the border? Kelly McCovers was there when this assassination after assassination, murder of bus drivers broke out in San Salvador. One day, 8 dead. Police would come out to talk about it, and they're afraid as well. Faces covered, cameras. Don't point that camera at my face. Here's a little bit from that, from the street about a block away from the crime scene where one of those drivers was killed. From Embedded, Kelly McCovers in El Salvador with Jasmine Garce, her interpreter.
So everybody's gathered around the police tape.
And an officer comes up to talk. He'll only tell us his last name, Lopez. Like all the other cops, he has his face covered. And the camera guys won't even point at his face. They'll point at his boots or something else. Which means when you turn on the TV, you might hear the cops' voices, but all you see is this tight shot of like a badge or something. Even the cops are that scared to identify themselves, talking about the gangs. Here goes Officer Lopez.
A eso de las 19:35 horas tuvimos conocimiento de este hecho que estamos observando en este momento, ¿verdad? Efectivamente.
So they attacked the bus line right before it was about to turn into the terminal, and there were still passengers in it.
Durante todo el día se montaron dispositivos enfocados a poder colaborarle.
So they're casting a net in various areas, and he can't tell you what areas.
Colaborarle al sector transporte, específicamente al sector.
We don't know why this happened, but we can tell you that there's a pattern. You too have seen this pattern.
Todo el día, ustedes mismos lo han presenciado. Gracias.
That was the press conference.
They're from Embedded in San Salvador. It was not a good day. Kelly McCovers, interpreter, Jasmine Garce there as well. And headlines all over the table in front of me right now. Gangs declare war on police as El Salvador violence rages. Kelly's with us from California. Stella in Worcester, Massachusetts. Stella, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air. What do you know?
it's just kind of surreal hearing this. My family's from El Salvador. I grew up in El Salvador, too.
Yeah.
And my parents just actually got back from a trip, and thankfully they were not harmed. They were not anything while they were there. They were really safe.
What are you thinking when you hear this report, Stella?
It's alarming. Thankfully, my family isn't from San Salvador. They're from the Orient, so the East.
Mm-hmm.
But it's terrifying that part of the country's that way, but I also think it's fair to mention that not the entire country is this way.
Do your parents speak of El Salvador, given that subtlety, and maybe not even subtle, it's just some parts worse than others, do they think El Salvador's in crisis, or does it sound like, oh, it's not that bad?
Sure.
They do.
No, they do. It's painful. It's painful to know that this is all stemming back from the Civil War and that mm-hmm. these are conflicts that never were resolved before, but they still felt safe enough to travel there. I myself don't feel that way yet, but I'm hopeful that soon I can. I just had a daughter, and I'd like her to meet the country.
Of course.
It's gonna be a little bit before it settles down, I think.
I'm so glad your parents were able to visit and come safely back, Stella, and I appreciate your call very much. Kelly McKeever, stand by there in Culver City. With us right now as well from Washington is Adriana Beltran. She leads the Citizen Security Program at the Washington Office on Latin America. Adriana, thank you very much for being with us and with Kelly McKeever today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Tom.
Why is this happening?
Well, you have to remember, the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, has been facing endemic levels of violence. Unfortunately, due, I would say, to the emphasis that has tended to be placed in zero-tolerance policies to address the violence and the gang phenomenon that you have and you have had in El Salvador, it has led to increasing levels of violence. As was mentioned, partially due to the fact that the gang truce fell apart, homicide rate last year reached 103 per 100,000 citizens. That was a 70% increase from the year before.
How does that rank globally, Adriana?
Globally, it has made El Salvador the most violent country in the world, not at war.
Wow. Our caller says these are unresolved issues from El Salvador's civil war with roots back in the 80s and deeper, 70s. What do you say?
That's true. I mean, you had, a 12-year civil war. Unfortunately, I would say that although there have been steps that have been taken to strengthen the criminal justice institutions, to create an accountable and a professional police force, to create a strong, independent, and effective attorney general's office and judiciary, we have not seen the progress that we would have liked. And so you have a country that is facing extremely high levels of violence on the one hand, and on the other hand, a criminal justice system, from the police on to the judiciary that is hampered by evidence of corruption, of inefficiency, and of a lack of resources.
And
to put that into perspective, the conviction rate in El Salvador, when you compare it to the homicide rate, is 5%.
Wow. In the country with the worst murder rate in the world. We've got a caller right now from San Pedro Sula in Honduras. Jorge, thank you for calling. You're on the air in the U.S.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I was listening to you talking about El Salvador, what's going on there. And actually, San Pedro Sula, Honduras, like a month and a half ago, was actually the most violent city in the world. And then El Salvador took over. So we were practically living the same situation. And I want to give you like a resume of what is happening. The gangs are obviously taking over because they work for drug dealers. And drug dealers is practically got even into inside the government because they had that much money. And the government is taking very bad decisions, and that's what's practically ruining the country because they let the drug dealers take over the country. Then the gang members work for drug dealers, so they are destroying the country, and they are trying to sell us practically a better country. But how? If the corruption is from inside, from the top, from bourgeoisie,
Yes. No, Jorge, I understand. I mean, I had a close family member shot in Honduras working there with a medical team. It's rough, and we know the numbers are bad there as well. You point to issues right in the midst of the government itself, drug money and all that, we'll look at it. It goes right down to individual citizens, and the dynamics are just so overwhelming. Kelly McEvers and her crew brought out this tape from San Salvador. She talks with Roberto, the El Salvadoran journalist working with her, about gangs and if they have targeted anyone that he knows personally. And he tells them, you may have heard a bit of this, but listen closely here about the terrible human dynamic here. He tells them, this is Roberto, a story about a friend of his daughter, Jasmine Garst, is here translating.
Hay una historia de una niña que...
A girl who's 13 years old.
Una madre soltera.
The mother lived in a neighborhood that was controlled by a gang. At one point, the gang said the mother had to do work for them. They said if the mother didn't do it, they would kill her daughter. So the mother started working for the gang, or collaborating, as Roberto tells it.
Y de pronto a un pandillero le gustó la hija de la señora.
And then one day, a gang member really liked the 13-year-old daughter.
Le dijo de que quería a su hija como novia.
The gang member told her, I want your daughter as a girlfriend.
Y la señora se negó.
And the lady said no. She said, I'll collaborate you, whatever you want, but don't touch my daughter.
Y el pandillero insistió y le dijo que si no...
So the gang member insisted and said, if you do not collaborate, I'm going to kill you and the girl's grandmother.
So the girl was forced to marry the gang member.
Tiene ahora 15 años.
Now she's 15.
Y está por parir su segundo hijo.
She's about to have her second child.
Oh, my God.
Le arruinaron su vida.
They ruined her life.
Antes de los 18 años,
before she was 18. Now she has two kids.
Es esposa de un pandillero.
She's the wife of a gangbanger.
Que la golpea.
He beats her.
A ella, a sus hijos.
He beats their children.
La obliga a consumir droga.
He forces her to take drugs.
O sea, que es una niña que se metió en un mundo oscuro sin merecerlo y sin pedirlo.
She was got involved in a dark, dark world without asking for it and without deserving it.
From Embedded, it could just make you cry. John in McAllen, Texas, down on the border. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hey. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I just wanted to say that the same trip these kids are taking, I took it back in 89. Pretty much the same thing happened to us. We had these gang members show up and pretty much say, you either give us money or we'll kill you. My family was farmers.
Yeah.
You had no money.
Yeah.
Luckily, my mom had migrated a few years before us here. And we're sending money back. She managed to collect some money and get a human smuggler to smuggle us across from Mexico, through Guatemala, Mexico, and then through the border here in the United States.
And all these years later, John, it's still going on. What do you think about the situation there now? What should happen? What needs to be done?
You know what? Part of this was because of a lot of these gang members were thrown from L.A. back to El Salvador. So when they got there, they saw these people that were unarmed, and they just started doing these horrific acts of violence, and they just gotten worse and worse. What needs to be done is it's just difficult to pretty much say what needs to be done because there's so much corruption. So to clean the system, it's not, you know, there's no easy solution.
Yeah. John, I appreciate your call from McAllen. I'm glad that you made it. I'm glad you're still watching sympathetically as others wrestle with this. Kelly, is this about gangbangers being returned from Los Angeles?
That's what we hear from a lot of researchers and people in El Salvador. You know, these were people who left El Salvador in the 80s and 90s during the brutal civil war and were able to come here to the United States. And then in the 90s, we know that thousands of Salvadorans were deported back from the U.S. to El Salvador again for criminal activity, for gang activity. So these are people who formed street gangs here, primarily here in Los Angeles, but in other places too, you know, because that's how you protected yourself, and that's how you were in the world. Nobody's making excuses for anyone, but that was life in Los Angeles. And then once they were convicted of certain crimes, they were deported back, and they took that way of life with them, and formed these gangs back in El Salvador. I mean, that is the story you hear over and over and over from people in El Salvador, a place that was already broken and battered from so many years at war.
Wanda is calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Wanda. What do you know?
Hi. Yes, my name is Rhonda Weber. I'm a clinical psychologist who's worked with a lot of immigrants from the Northern Triangle here in the Harrisonburg, Virginia area. both with providing psychotherapy to them and their families, and to also asylum and evaluations for immigration.
Okay.
Because a lot of their family members are at risk of being deported back to very unsafe situations like you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when they're deported back to any of these areas from the Northern Triangle in Central America, they're at high risk of kidnapping of themselves or their family members, since the communities know that they're coming back from the U.S. The assumption is that they have access to money, or that there are relatives here in the U.S. that can be continually extorted for money. And
yeah.
So it's a very tough situation. And if you look at the murder rates, you know, they might be around a quarter of the rates of deaths in Syria, which is horrifying. And anybody who comes from any of those countries will tell you that the majority of folks don't even report murders because, as you indicated earlier in the broadcast, even the police are afraid to be identified as being at a murder scene. Because if it's a gang-related murder, if you report it, you and your family can be victims in the future.
Boy, it's just overwhelming. Story after story here. How does that work, Adriana? How are things so sewn up by the gangs that they know everybody's story? They know who's got relatives in the States. They know who's coming back. It's hard to even picture. That sounds like, you know, the old East German stories of the Stasi, but this is just street gangs.
Right. I think Stella, you know, raised a good point in our call, and mentioning that, you know, the homicide rate that we talk about, it's not as if the entire country is facing these endemic levels of violence and homicides. But in fact, you do have, you know, gangs tend to control certain territories. And so they tend to control very marginalized communities where, you know, many of the low-income poor families live, where you have minimal to no real state presence. And so, you know, when many kids are deported back, they often end up going back, you know, to these same communities where they came from, where everybody knows everybody. And it makes it very easy for them to be targeted.
Let me get Jose calling from Boston. Jose, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I would like to add a couple. I'm from Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
I was educated here in the United States. I went to Harvard, and I have just returned from Honduras about 8 months ago because the situation is much worse than your program right now can describe.
Wow.
The murders in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are not being reported. We have massacres. It's not just murders. It's massacres of 10, 20 people, entire families.
Aye.
Just recently in Honduras, a whole neighborhood, the gang members came and said, you have 24 hours to leave, and everybody left. But what you are not discussing is the role of the United States in not ending this tragedy for the people of Honduras.
How, Jose? What should be done? What do you see the role? What?
So Honduras right now, we had protests last summer.
Yes.
Anti-corruption. And we were demanding, the people of Honduras were demanding an international commission. And because we now have a dictator for president after the coup in 2009,
mm-hmm.
we have a dictator who now wants to become, you know, an eternal president.
I've just got half a minute before the break. What should happen with U.S. policy, Jose?
We need to stop having companies that go to Honduras take away the land of the people, which forces people to come to the United States. And we need to have international intervention that is not military, but it has to do with land ownership, so that people have their land, so that people can work. And most importantly, we need to stop that the United States supports the dictatorship that Honduras has right now, who has started the death squads and killing people left and right. In fact, right now, if you look at Honduran news, it is the police who has been now named responsible for the murder. This was in the New York Times. For the murder of all the people who have fought against the drug deals in Honduras.
Jose, I'm grateful for your call, testifying there to what you've seen in Honduras. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the astonishing violence on the streets of Central America, specifically El Salvador, with Kelly McEvers, host of the NPR podcast Embedded, the third episode just out. It's on a very bad day in San Salvador. Kelly and her crew right in the middle of it. She joins us from NPR West in California, Culver City today. Adriana Beltran is with us as well from the Office on Latin America, Washington Office on Latin America. And you can join us. What will it take to bring civil society back to Latin America? I mean, some of the tape here, people are responding to this, Kelly. You know, AC says, I just feel angry and sick. Brandon says, we can't just open the border to every refugee in the world while the U.S. and the rest of the world ignore the reasons why refugees are fleeing it. The reason sounds overwhelming. On the other hand, Jim writes to us on Twitter, says, sending people back to this horror or using them as a campaign trope is just plain wrong. I want to play just a little bit more from Embedded. This is where the Salvadoran journalist Roberto, who's working with you, and Jasmine Garce, who's interpreting, tells you that his family lives in an area full of gangs. And this is a working journalist there. And you, the emotion's just incredible. He says, we don't mess with them. They don't mess with us. But everything's a mess. Here's Jasmine translating.
Alrededor de tanta violencia.
It's hard living surrounded by so much violence.
Llegar una noche a mi casa y decirle a mi hija, y mi pregunta a mi hija, papá, ¿cómo te fue?
And to get home at night and for my daughter to be like, Dad, how did your day go?
Porque estoy de regreso, no me pasó nada.
And to have to say, I had a good day because I got back home.
Y ocultarle a mi hija cuando me pregunta, ¿y qué viste?
And nothing happened to me. And have to hide from my daughter.
Vi cinco muertos este día.
When she says, so tell me what you saw.
No puedo
and to have to say, I saw five dead bodies today.
Entonces le miento.
Can't tell her. And so I lie to her.
Que fuimos a la playa con un cliente o que fuimos a una montaña.
And I say, we went to the beautiful beach and we saw a beautiful mountain.
Aunque ella vea televisión.
Even though she sees the television.
No me gusta que ella absorba esto.
I don't.
Para mí, mi hija es.
I don't like her absorbing all this. My daughter is everything.
Y por eso trabajo duro, duro, para que ella nunca le falte nada.
And that's why I work so hard for her to never lack anything.
From Embedded, the journalist Roberto just breaking down there. John in Berea, Kentucky. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I lived for a couple of years in El Salvador, and so I have a lot of friends both in El Salvador and here in the States now. Mm. I recently spoke with a friend who is now getting desperate and wants out, and my wife and I are trying to convince him to not come here because the situation is so rough here. When you were talking to your last caller, it seemed like you were asking a really key question, like, what can we do in the U.S., especially our U.S. government, in terms of policy to make a difference? And it would seem to me we need to examine the drug war, because it seems like the drug war has been such a failure, and it seems that the gangs thrive on narcotics as a key lifeline for them. So I wonder what your guest, especially Adriana, would think if we could succeed, as Bernie Sanders says, to legalize marijuana and other drugs, if we could undercut the power of the gangs.
John, thank you for calling. Adriana, what do you say?
Well, I would say, you know, it's a very good question. I think in terms of U.S. policy and what the role of the U.S. should be, I think, and we have a great opportunity right now, given the $750 million that was approved at the end of last year, in terms of, I would say, investing in prevention, in community-based prevention, because we know it can work. It has worked in communities in El Salvador even, has worked in communities across Latin America and in the U.S., investing in rehabilitation, in addressing the issue of corruption that was mentioned earlier, but also investing in generating opportunities, work opportunities for youth, because something that hasn't been mentioned is that you have, you know, a swath of the population, young population, that doesn't have an opportunity to either work or study.
But do those things work, Adriana? I mean, it sounds like a war zone where, no doubt, this is a good idea, but do we need more than that? Do we need some kind of bigger intervention? I don't know what.
Well, and greater attention needs to be given to the criminal justice system and to really strengthening the institutions, because you have extremely weak police force. You know, most of the criminal investigations, for instance, are based on witness testimony, so they lack a lot of capacity addressing the issue of internal corruption, addressing the issue of strengthening the judiciary, strengthening the attorney general's office, and ensuring that people can actually turn to their authorities.
One more call. I'll bring it to you, Kelly. Marlon in Charlottesville, Virginia. Marlon, you're on the air.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm originally from Honduras. Mm-hmm. I was there just last week. My comment is not what the problem is. Everybody knows what the problem is. I will address a solution. A solution in this case for the United States, how we could intervene, is on education. If we give these kids a way out, something else to do than join gangs, there will be hope, maybe not for this generation, but the other generation to come. Like in the 70s and 80s when we were taught communism was bad, me including, that was a good strategy. So that generation grew up thinking Russia's bad, Cuba's bad, communism is bad. And we were given a way out, which was the army. Nowadays, the army doesn't recruit anymore. Nobody wants to join. And there's basically no way for a kid to get education over there.
Marlon, I so appreciate your call. I've got to get in there and educate. I mean, that's always a good idea, but it sounds so daunting. Kelly, what have you come away from your embedded time there thinking about path forward?
You know, when you think about these gangs, I think it's important to think about them almost as mafias. These are people who, as Adriana said, they control territory. So, some parts of El Salvador are completely fine because they're not controlled by the gangs. But many of the places that are controlled by the gangs, like she said, where there are people at the sort of the edges of society, people who are poor and vulnerable. And so when a group like this provides the sort of order and stability that nobody else can provide, and you're a 14-year-old kid, it's going to be appealing, if not, you know, compulsory. I mean, there's times when I remember I met a kid from El Salvador with his mother and sister managed to come here to the United States mm-hmm. in that surge in 2014. He's now like the star of the football team in here in Los Angeles, you know, and he was explaining as, you know, I didn't want to hang out with these guys, but when they give you no choice, when they basically go to your mother's beauty salon and say, you owe us $200 a month in rent money. They call it renta, right? This is how they operate like a mafia. And if you can't pay it, which of course she can't because that's a lot of money, then your son is going to have to work with us. We're going to have to take that money. So it's this, you know, it's extortion basically. And so what is the son going to do? You know, every day he's going to school, he's getting on the bus, he's trying to get an education, he's trying to do all the right things, but they keep coming after him and keep coming after him and saying, you know, we're going to go after your mom and take her money if you don't work with us. What choice does this guy have? And that's really the question.
Kelly, you put us right on the streets there. We're not going to solve this one today, but you make it much more palpable to us in the complexity of it. We could do a whole hour on policy, and we should do that. We should do it soon. I'm grateful that you all were alert enough to pivot, even as you were looking at one piece of this, and look at another and bring it to us in such a vivid way. It really opens our eyes. Thank you for that, Kelly.
Sure.
Kelly McEvers.
Happy
to have you with us today. Kelly McEvers, co-host of All Things Considered and host of the NPR podcast Embedded. And Adriana Beltran, please keep up the work, and let's talk again. This needs more attention. Thank you for joining us from the Washington office on Latin America. Thank you, Adriana.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we will hear the latest on Brazil's political crisis and impeachment moves against Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. This is On Point. The political crisis in Brazil ratcheted up another notch last night. The country's parliament, the lower house, voted to impeach embattled Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, making her removal ever more likely. Now more unpopular than ever, it appears, Rousseff is fighting to keep her presidency, arguing Brazil's political and economic crisis will deepen if she is ousted. Here's a little sound from that rowdy showdown yesterday at the Brazilian chamber in Brasilia, lawmakers voting to approve impeachment proceedings against President Rousseff.
Verdade para a democracia! Por isso eu digo ao Brasil, sim para o futuro!
And just last week, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff accusing those calling for her impeachment of staging a coup, interpreted here by Euronews.
If there was any doubt about the coup, the farce and the betrayal that is underway, there is no more. If there was any doubt about my denunciation that there is a coup d'etat underway, there cannot be any more.
But in the streets of Brazil, everybody's talking about all this and, well, lots of opinions. This was last month. Thousands in the streets of Sao Paulo protesting against the president, Dilma Rousseff. One protester talking to CNN called for others to demand her resignation.
I think to impeach legally, it's more complicated. That's why my suggestion would be that everybody should ask for the president to quit, because she could quit any moment, you know? And this would expedite the whole process.
Well, now there's a legal step toward impeachment. Joining me now for the latest from Brasilia is Paulo Trevisani, covers politics and the economy in Brasilia for the Wall Street Journal. Paulo, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Exactly where does this impeachment push stand now? One house has voted for it. What remains?
Well, now it goes to the Senate. House Speaker Eduardo Cunha is delivering this afternoon the case to the neighboring Senate, and now it goes for a trial in the Senate.
So does the Senate vote first to impeach, or that's already set up by the lower house and now the trial is on?
Well, the Senate needs to hold an initial vote,
okay.
But that one is kind of easy. All it takes is a simple majority. So everybody is taking for granted that the case will be accepted and the trial will begin in the next couple of weeks or so.
We heard Dilma Rousseff saying coup. And today at a press conference, you have the Solicitor General of the country, this is José Eduardo Cardoso, insisting that she has not committed a crime, won't be going anywhere. Please listen to this with us, Paulo.
This break with the Constitution is, in our view, a coup. A coup against the democracy. A coup against the 54 million Brazilians who voted for Dilma Rousseff.
This is a huge country, a huge now trouble, but nevertheless very large economy. What about the simple legality of what is unfolding? You've got the president and a solicitor general saying it's not constitutional, it's a coup. Are the grounds for that kind of legal objection to what's going on, Paulo?
Well, that's a tough one. I like to think of it as if you are watching a murder trial and you're listening to the prosecution and the defense lawyers. They're all talking about the same thing, but they have totally different visions or opinions and views about what's going on. I think that's the same thing here. You have the president's camp saying the impeachment is totally against the Constitution, but then you have everybody else saying that, no, forget about it. The one who broke the Constitution is the president, and she needs to be ousted. So, the Senate will be the court of law, so to speak, for the next months or so, and they will decide, and Brazil have to accept whatever decision they make.
What are the allegations against the president? What grounds for impeachment are being put forward?
Oh, that's interesting. The president is being accused of fiscal irresponsibility. She's accused of cooking the books, basically, to disguise the poor state of public finances. Now, the law says that if the president does that, she should be pushed out. But she argues that she never cooked the books. Her accounting was totally illegal. And that's the debate we're going to try at the Senate.
I think I understand that the allegation is that she borrowed from some state banks or government banks to cover shortfalls, or what exactly is alleged there?
Yeah, well, that's part of the accusations. Under Brazil's law, the president cannot borrow from the state banks, right? But she says that the transactions that are now being called loans were not loans. She's saying that she just delayed payments to the banks.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's kind of a gray area there. These banks, they make payments to the people who are beneficiaries of government programs. Well, so the banks pay people and the Treasury provides the funds to the banks. But, you know, comes the end of the month, the Treasury didn't make all that deposit in the bank.
So it stays there as sort of a withdrawal account, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Let me ask you, if I may, our time is short. What about the whole corruption scandal that has touched so many in the political class and beyond in Brazil? Has the corruption scandal touched the president herself, Dilma Rousseff? Is that part of the impeachment proceedings or not?
No, it's not. Absolutely not. And that's the irony of it. A lot of the people who are actually impeaching the president are being targeted by the corruption investigation. Some of them are being charged already. But no, the president is not accused or even being investigated by any of that.
Well, maybe she's right then. Maybe they're trying to cover their own misdeeds by throwing her out.
Maybe they are. And maybe the next people who come into power, if she's really ousted, could wake up in jail the next day. That's the biggest uncertainty looming over Brazil right now.
What's the heart of this? You're with the Wall Street Journal. Is it the fall in oil prices that's cut the legs out, or China's slow economy cut the legs out of the Brazilian economy?
Yes, Brazil rolled really high in the commodities boom, thanks mainly to China. And since the boom burst, Brazil has been in big trouble.
Well, it's got plenty of trouble right now with impeachment moves rolling ahead against the president, Dilma Rousseff, there. Paulo Trevisani, covering Brazil for the Wall Street Journal. You're terrific. Please join us again. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation front to back and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.